Good evening. Welcome to the class on creation science. We're going to be covering tonight. We're going to jump into the origins of life and where all of this life came from, and all the things that we talk about genetics, and we're going to talk about eventually we're going to get into the subject of mutations and a lot of different things, including bacterial flagellum and why they're important to the creation science argument. We're going to talk about some more probabilities. Probabilities are one of those things that I find interesting, especially when you look at it in terms of the possibility of all of this coming about by accident. So we're going to talk about quite a bit of things tonight. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get rolling here. So the thing is that man, as conscious beings, and self-aware, of course, we've always sought to know from whence we came. Love that one. I did that one just for my wife. She's in the room. From whence we came. The origin of life on this planet has been a subject of discussion in every culture, in every time, in every place. Every culture has some sort of an answer for how we came about. And whether it's here on the earth, or they look out to the stars and they try to find the answers there, every culture has had its own ideas. Despite the many differences in opinion, most of them have some sort of grounding in a higher power. And interestingly enough, the only ones that don't have a higher power involved of whatever sort is modern man. The atheistic approach basically is the only culture, the only philosophy that has ever existed on the face of the planet that has tried to remove any kind of a greater creator from all of this. But there's a desire to understand not just the how, but the why of this too. You know, the how is one thing, and the how is something that I am convinced that this side of glory we're never going to know. We're never going to know exactly how God created everything. We're just not. We're not. I don't think we're capable of it in this fleshly body. I think that there's more to this than we will ever be able to discover scientifically, or I guess I can use the word spiritually in that regard. There's more to this than we're ever going to really be able to discover and prove. We're never going to be able to go back and say this is exactly how God did it and start all over and do it again. It's never going to happen. So, at any rate, there is a question of the question of why is really the biggest question. This is what cultures have always tried to deal with: is why are we here? Whether it's the creator from the perspective of, you know, the Ra, the sun god of the Egyptians, or the Greek god Gaia, to today's atheistic god of chance. All cultures have attempted to answer the great cosmic question of our existence, and at the same time, explain the creator, whatever that might be. Now, with every advancement in technology and science, there's new revelations that illustrate the awesome complexity and amazing beauty of the creation around us. Now, all of this continues to lead mankind back to the source, which is, of course, the creator. I was talking to David Dunbar last night, and I often end my prayers as basically helping to remind myself that Christ isn't just the last resort, but he is our first resource. And David Dunbar had a little bit of a play on words, and he says, well, isn't he the first source, not the resource? I'm like, yeah. So anyway, the thing is that the search for the why always leads us back to the source of that desire, which is ultimately the creator. And we all know that God puts within us the need for to find him. Yes, Mr. City. It's on the Facebook page. Okay. It's the same number that, if you look at the link, does she have the link? It's on Facebook. Okay. Either that or I can just give it to you real quick, actually. It's right here, sorry. 760-503-557. Okay, so at any rate, the search for why always leads us back to the creator. And ultimately, in every culture that truly seeks this out, seeks out the true creator, they will find God and the one true God. If you look at, say, the Egyptian theologies or any of the Norse gods or any other really religions, there are always fundamental flaws in their search for why. And those fundamental flaws usually deal with the fact that their gods are generally very flawed. I mean, if you look at the Norse gods or you look at the Egyptian gods, they were not perfect. They weren't able to create. By themselves, they weren't omniscient. By themselves, they weren't omnipotent, so on and so forth. So there's always a problem. But when you search out truth, you truly do come to the point where you will find God. And of course, today, there are two totally opposite explanations for the origin of the universe and really the origin of life on this planet. Now, each of these opposing explanations, of course, has its own worldview. And those two worldviews we'll talk about real quickly. But before we get to that, we have to understand that there is only one of these that can be true because they are completely opposite. Okay? The two cannot coexist. Could you give one of those copies to Lorenzo, please? I'm not sure if anybody else came in late either. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Anyway, only one of these can be true. The two cannot coexist. Each of these opposing explanations has as its core an entire worldview of philosophy, of origins, destinies, of life and of meaning and of point and all those things. And so one of these, of course, is evolution, and the other explanation is creation. And as we know, these two views are very much in opposition to one another. So let's talk a little bit about the basic philosophies between these two. In evolution, the basic philosophy is that everything in the universe that we can see, that we can detect, that we can even ponder about, came into its current existence through random chance, the processes that are supposedly continuing to happen today, without any sort of supernatural involvement. The origin and development of the universe and all life in it can be explained by time and chance and continuing processes. Now, the continuing part is important to understand because this is generally referred to, this process is generally referred to as uniformitarianism. Essentially what that is, and we'll talk about it more when we get into the geology aspect of this, but uniformitarianism says when we observe something happening today, that is the way that it has always been. And so then they extrapolate from that observation and then try to apply it to something that happened long ago. An example would be in geology is where it's most commonly applied, but it applies here as well, is they can look at how much shoreline is lost around a bend in the Yellowstone River every year. And they can take that extrapolation, that amount of data or that amount of shoreline that's lost, and then supposedly rewind the clock and assume that that same amount of loss this year or over a series of years was the same amount that occurred, in their case, millions of years ago, which is where we get part of the explanation from the atheistic worldview for the creation of the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon poses many problems in that regard, but we'll get to those when we talk about the geology prospect. In terms of evolution, in organic evolution specifically, uniformitarianism basically says that if we see cells divide now, then that's how it started in the beginning, and that same exact process is what's in place now. Now, to a certain extent, that's applicable. However, they take out the miraculous, so there's no way to explain how it started in the first place. So we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move forward here. So, again, another basic philosophy or basic tenet of the philosophy of evolution is that all life originated from a single-celled organism that came from non-living matter. So, remember that scientific laws of information that I gave you? Remember I said we're going to come back to this and we're going to talk about it and we're going to use it? This is where it's coming back in. Because ultimately, the very premise of evolution violates the scientific laws of information. Remember, the scientific laws of information say that a material entity cannot generate a non-material entity. In other words, life comes from living matter. Okay? So, the basic philosophy of evolution is that life came from a non-living thing. Why is the scientific law of information a law? Why is that a law? Because remember when we talked about it at first, we talked about how natural laws are explained, how they're derived, and how they come about. And part of it is because we've never observed it, and part of it's simply because of the reality of what information is, and that it cannot be produced from any non-material item. So when we first started talking about this, the scientific laws of information, and really started with the class, we took the same laws that we took from natural science and took that same logic to and applied it to information and came up with these laws. I didn't do it, of course. But Dr. Werner Gitt did.
And so does the opposite also apply in that we don't see non-living matter coming from living matter coming from non-living matter?
Correct. Yes, it is. And actually, we'll talk a little bit about that today if we get to that point. At any rate, that's part of the theory of evolution. And one of the things that's interesting in this is that the creation worldview is centered around a couple of things. The creation worldview has a much different approach. It basically says that the universe is not self-contained. What we mean by that is that the universe didn't create itself. It is not eternal. Remember the things we talked about in cosmology and teleonomy, that the universe itself cannot explain its own existence. That the universe is not all there is. The physical universe is not all there is. The creation worldview also takes the stand that the universe was created by the deliberate act of God. Pretty obvious, at least from this perspective. And of course, a couple of other things here, that the processes to create the universe are not continuing today. This is an important one. It's not something we're going to talk too much about in the class, but the basic philosophy of evolution is that the very concept of evolution, the assumption is made that the processes that created the universe in the first place can continue and do continue. So there's a tenet in evolutionary theory called the multiverse, basically saying that our universe is one in many, of many. Any of you have, what's the word? It's necessarily telling you to see it, but have you ever seen Men in Black, old movie from the 90s, Will Smith? Okay, you remember how that movie ended? You remember they were looking for the galaxy anyway, and there's a marble. It ends up being that there's a big alien, he's got a bag full of marbles, and every marble is a galaxy, and every galaxy is a marble. It's essentially a rather comical, but logical, if you will, correlation to the multiverse theory. But in opposition to that, of course, is a creation model that says that these processes are not continuing today, that it was a one-time act of God, that in the 6 days that God created the heavens and the earth, he created everything once and it's done. And that's not only a scriptural tenet, but it's also something that is seen within the examination of the universe itself. So the other thing, one of the other tenets here is that these processes that are responsible for the creation of the universe, the earth, and all life on it, including the basic types of plants, animals, humans, etc., that they are responsible for the creation of all those things. So what we mean by what the creation model says is that the processes that created all of the universe are responsible for life and everything in it, and that those things created life with the direct intention of God. In other words, it's not as if God seeded the planet and dumped a little bit of evolution in there and just let it run. The creation worldview says that God created things with intent. with the ability to reproduce, with the ability to have different kinds within kind, different species within kind is what we would say. So at any rate, obviously there are two very different worldviews in this. So there are two possibilities here. There are two and only two possibilities concerning origins. And one or the other of them must be true. And the one that best explains all the evidence is the better model. So, those two possibilities really begin with all things can or cannot be explained in terms of ongoing natural processes in a self-contained universe. Either it can or it can't. So, if they can, if we can look out into the universe, whether it be through a microscope or a telescope, if we can look out there and see that all the things that are going on now, natural processes that supposedly brought about the creation of the universe itself, can be shown that they can continue to work, that they can actually do it, that they can actually explain the universe's existence, then evolution is true. So in other words, if we can prove that macro/organic evolution actually happens, and then we can extrapolate backward and show how it started at the beginning, then evolution is true. However, if we look to the universe and we cannot see the thing, we cannot find an explanation for life in the things of the universe, then the creation is true. And that's really what it comes down to. This is really the essential points of this argument. So before we get too much into that, so we do need to define evolution. There are six different kinds of evolution as defined. Dr. Kent Hovind, I believe his moniker was Dr. Dino. He had a rather interesting perspective. He defined six different kinds of evolution. And one of them is actually happens. One of them is actually observable. Okay? So we've got cosmic evolution, chemical evolution, stellar and planetary evolution, organic evolution, macroevolution, and microevolution. So one of these actually does occur. But we would know it as a different name. And I'll use my example to illustrate this. And I'm sure many of you probably know which one it is, but Kevin can say it for me. All chihuahuas are dogs, but not all dogs are chihuahuas, right? Okay? On the other side of that coin, all cats are evil. So that's just the end of the story. But at any rate, microevolution is the one that happens. And all microevolution is change within kind. What we would know it as is adaptation. So, for instance, you can take many different examples, but you look at, the wolves and other dogs. Now, did wolves evolve into a different kind or type of animal that could live in the forest? And then the chihuahuas evolved into a different kind? No, they're still the same kind. You can still interbreed. That'd be a funny-looking animal. But they can still interbreed. But the reality is that the animals that were born in that environment, in a climate where it got very, very cold, the ones that had longer fur would live and be able to reproduce. And they would pass on their genetic information to the next generation. The ones that were born with shorter hair, they either left or they died. It's called adaptation. We'll talk about a few more examples of that when we get into the mutation aspect. But just so that you know, cosmic evolution essentially is the approach of trying to understand and explain the origin of time, space, and matter. In other words, it's the Big Bang Theory. That's cosmic evolution. Chemical evolution is the origin of higher elements from hydrogen. That is why there's such angst over the discovery of water on Mars. And one of the moons of Jupiter, Europa, I believe it is, that they think that there's frozen water underneath them, there hills. Well, hydrogen, of course, as we talked about before, is a major component to life and to the necessity of life. But chemical evolution basically states that hydrogen was the beginning of all of that, and that chemicals evolved, matched themselves up to create higher forms of molecules. Stellar and planetary evolution is the origin of the stars and planets, how they came about. This is something that continues to be studied, of course. Organic evolution is the origin of life, or our focus is going to be on organic evolution. And macroevolution is, of course, changing from one kind into another. This is where it's basically the missing link aspect, that macroevolution states that we all came from monkeys. Okay? And, of course, microevolution is variation within kinds, and only this one has been observed. So, before considering the origins of life too much more, let's talk a little bit about organic evolution, define it a bit more carefully. Organic evolution is, as theorized, is a naturally occurring beneficial change that produces increasing and inheritable complexity and is the mechanism responsible for the origin of life. A couple of things here that I want to point out. Number one is beneficial change, increasing and inheritable complexity. Now, a beneficial change, that code word is essentially mutation. Beneficial mutation is really what you could say is being inferred there. And we're going to talk about mutations because mutations are supposedly the mechanism, the engine behind organic evolution. And of course, in order for evolution to be true, it would have to be passing on increasing and inheritable complexity. At some point, we'll watch another video, probably after this section. Many of us have seen it before, but it's called Evolution's Achilles Heels. And in it, there's actually a horribly depressing portion, at least I think I look at it as horribly depressing, where it talks about basically the second law of thermodynamics and how it functions on the genetic code and how every one of us, as we reproduce and as we live, our bodies inherit more mutations and we pass those mutations on to all future generations. And our children will have many times more mutations in them than us, than the parents. Well, what does that mean? It means that we get older faster. It means that we need more medications. It means all kinds of things, that we fall apart more. I mean, that genetic entropy is real. I mean, there's an entire devotion of study to this. So, at any rate, that flies in the face of passing on increasingly an inheritable complexity to the next generation. So, a couple of other things here. It's also called macroevolution or vertical evolution. Vertical evolution means, of course, the assumption would be moving up the evolutionary chain, if you will. So, in order to study this, really, in order to study the origin of the universe and specifically life, we have to remember that we cannot speak about it as if we were there, because none of us was there. We can't roll back the clock. We can't go back in time, and despite what YouTube tells you. You can't go back in time and see what happened on that first day. We must remember that this is outside of our sphere of ability. We cannot observe it. So then any scientific discussion must be based upon certain assumptions, hypotheses, or theories put in place after the fact. And this is important because I think those of us that think about this, and hopefully you guys have come to this conclusion as well, that creation, the whole creation worldview, is based upon several assumptions. The assumption that God exists. So, evolution is also based on several assumptions, but most people who study evolution will never deal with the fact that they're based upon assumptions. And we're going to talk about several of those assumptions. So let's define some things real quickly. And I know sometimes it seems like this stuff is obvious, but it's really important to think about it, especially in terms of being able to have a discussion with somebody who's well-schooled in this. But an assumption is something that is taken for granted. It represents a legitimate starting point for an investigation. It's essentially the first step in a hypothesis, the observation of some phenomenon, and then arriving at some assumption from there. It is a legitimate place to start. A hypothesis is basically an educated guess. or a tentative assumption. Okay? And a theory is a plausible general principle or set of principles that may be used to explain certain phenomena and that is supported by at least some documented facts. Okay? Facts are important. Okay? They are really important. So what's a fact? It's defined as an actual occurrence or something that has actual existence. Okay? So a theory, remember, is supported by documented facts. Remember the scientific method talks quite a bit about this. Talks about the observation of something, the generation of a hypothesis based upon that, the testing of that hypothesis, and then going back to the beginning, essentially, and keep looping through until you can prove it, until you can document facts. That's one of the reasons why medications in the United States are so bloody expensive, because they spend millions and millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to document facts about what certain chemicals do. So, facts are an actual occurrence and something that can be reproduced. Okay? Let's take a simple example of a match. You know, the wooden matches that you buy at the store for camping, or, you know, we don't have to light them, using lighter stoves anymore. But the thing is, their existence is based upon the fact that if you mix the right number of chemicals in the right order, in the right mixture, in the right process, that every time, or most of the time, you'll be able to scrape that on something rough and it'll light. That's a fact. It's a documented fact. That's how we can do this. It's a very simple explanation. But facts are important. Now, many evolutionists claim that evolution has been proven and is therefore a fact of science. So then the question becomes, is evolution a fact? Has it been documented to the point where we can say this happens every single time, it's observable in every situation, and it is an explanation for, we can make hypotheses based upon these facts? Well, we're going to see that organic evolution is not a fact. It has not been documented and is not a factual argument. Not as it is defined and often used. Evolution cannot be considered a fact because it is based on a number of non-provable assumptions. There are technically 7 non-provable assumptions that evolution is based on. And when we look at just a couple of these, you'll understand the difference between the assumption of creation, that God exists, and I'm going to use the rabbit ears and just say God, a creator. That's an assumption that the creation model takes or makes. However, in evolution, the non-provable assumptions that they make are completely against what we see in science and what we can observe. So, let's talk about a couple of these for just a moment. George Kirkwood, he's an evolutionist from Great Britain, he listed 7 such assumptions. Now, he's an evolutionist, and he said these are the very things that evolution's built on, just so you know, he's an evolutionist. Two of these primary ones are that, and he was being serious, by the way, that spontaneous generation must have occurred. So the question is, what is spontaneous generation? Well, spontaneous generation, before I get to the explanation, let me give the other one. Spontaneous generation must have only occurred once, by the way. How convenient that in order for all of this to be true, something, I don't know what else to call it other than miraculous, such as spontaneous generation must have occurred, and it had to have only occurred once. Okay? So, and we'll talk a little bit more about these for just a second, but spontaneous generation is in direct opposition to the law of biogenesis or biogenesis, depending upon how you want to say that. But it states that living things come from living things. Okay? I mean, this is rocket science here, right? So we got to go out and write papers, and we should all get federal grants to spend millions of dollars of federal money to investigate that living things do, in fact, come from living things. Don't need to do that, of course. We know this. There's a steak for you. That steak came from a living thing, right? by itself, we can take that steak and we can bury it in the ground and grow our own cows, right? Wouldn't that be it? That was Mike Ferguson's joke, wasn't it? Just planting the chicks too close together. That's not the way that it works, right? Okay, so living things come from living things. For example, in 1668, Francisco Redi demonstrated that maggots did not, contrary to Aristotle's opinion, arise spontaneously from rotting meat. Okay? I took like a half a second to look up maggots to put a picture. I couldn't do it. Ugh, just grossed me out. Anyway, but Aristotle's assumption was that, based upon his observation, but it was a flawed observation, that his observation whether maggots arise spontaneously from rotting meat. The same assumption was also made about mice arising spontaneously from basically dirty sweat socks and grain. And the way that they would test the experiment was they'd take a piece of meat, they lay it out on the counter and wait for it to putrefy and rot, and geez, all of a sudden there's maggots in it someday, you know, a couple of days down the road. With the mice example, they do essentially the same thing. They take some sweaty socks, or clothing, of course, in the 1600s, but sweaty sweat socks is always a picture that I get in my mind, and they sprinkle some grain on it, and sure enough, there's mice. Geez, look at that. Just, you know, wow, that's pretty cool. However, what Francisco Redi did was he basically took two pieces of meat, he covered one with a glass jar, left the other open. Guess which one developed maggots? One that was left open. And he could repeat this over and over and over again. So it became a documented fact that essentially the same thing with the sweaty socks and the grain. Guess what? They were able to prove that time and time again. It became a documented fact. At any rate, spontaneous generation lies at the heart of evolution, and once again we see the evolutionary model in juxtaposition to proven scientific laws. Spontaneous generation is, as a foundational element to organic evolution, is nonsense. I have to tone down my rhetoric. It doesn't make sense. It's illogical. Because what we see, what we observe as scientific fact, is that life comes from life. That's the way that it works. And evolution, of course, is in direct opposition to that. And it's the very core, one of its basic foundational tenets. So, a couple of things about this is that spontaneous generation has never been observed, ever. And there's been many people's lives spent trying to prove spontaneous generation. Any attempt to produce living material from non-living material has failed miserably. And they've tried. Science has tried for many, many years. Now, one might bring up the Miller-Urey experiment from 1953 at the University of Chicago, where they were able to produce some of the organic components of life from an atmosphere of methane, ammonia, and water vapor. And, of course, they came up with methane, ammonia, and water vapor based upon the assumption of what they think the Earth's atmosphere was and, you know, all those trillions of years ago before anything existed. But the most basic amino acids were formed in the test tubes, but the atmosphere required to make them killed them immediately. So now, when we say kill them, remember that amino acids are not life. They are components. They're building blocks to life. But as soon as the atmosphere that was used to generate them created them, it destroyed them almost immediately. Yet this is still passed as an example or an explanation for how life came about on the earth in the goo, basically. And it's commonly called from goo to you. And that's still passed as an explanation. But because of the failure to replicate spontaneous generation, evolutionists simply assume that it happened. That, seriously. If you actually back somebody into a corner nicely in a conversation about evolution, you will eventually get them to the point where they're going to have to admit that life came about spontaneously from non-living matter or they're going to say it came from somewhere else, which would be panspermia, essentially coming from outer space, which doesn't answer the question, because where did that come from? But at any rate, evolutionists simply assume that it happened. And so, as we talked about, they also claim that it only happened once. Now, why is that? Well, this assumption is made because simply the complexity of DNA. DNA is an amazingly complex molecule. And all of life is composed of DNA of one shape or form, whether it's whether it's more numerous or less numerous. Because that code is so extremely complicated, and because it is virtually the same throughout all living things with only minor variations, evolutionists are forced to concede that the events that produced it must have occurred just once. To suggest that it could have happened more than once and that it produced exactly the same code each time would be ridiculous. No one would believe that, not even evolutionists. Evolutionists have been stated before, they've been quoted as saying, if we were to rewind time all the way back to the beginning and start all over, none of us would be here. Okay? Because it's so unlikely that it happened once, much less twice. So again, remember those two non-provable assumptions that lay at the core, at the foundation of evolution, are that spontaneous generation occurred and that it only occurred once. So let's consider then what you need to form a molecule to create a protein molecule by chance. So first of all, you have to have the right bonds between the amino acids. They can't just be any kind of bonds. It's not like you can take two amino acids and stick together with Cheese Whiz and hope that that's going to stick together and make some sort of protein. You have to have the exact right bonds between those two. And by the way, the information in order to create the bond had to have been in place in the first place. We'll leave that out for now. And you have to have only left-handed versions of the amino acids to create the chains. Third, you have to have amino acids that link up like letters in a sentence, and that the letters within the sentence would make sense, that they would form words within that sentence. Okay? So these are just a few components to this. And so the probability of creating a short functional protein being randomly created is a rather large number. It's one chance in 100,000 trillion, 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 trillion. I think that would be impossible. Just saying. Yes. Oh, you're jumping ahead of me. I'll get to that in just a second. So, more simply put, I guess, or maybe more briefly put, is that that is 1 in 10 to the 125th power. That's a 10 followed by 125 zeros. The number is astronomically huge. As I've mentioned before, and I'll mention it probably many times throughout this, the mathematicians do put a number on what they consider impossible. And that number is significantly smaller than 10 to the 125th power. Okay? So, the next question then, that Mike asked, there are between 300 and 500 protein molecules needed to create a minimally complex cell. So you take that number, 1 times 10 to the 125th power, and you multiply it by the minimum number, we'll say 300, just to be really generous, and you get a number that's much larger, because remember, when you start multiplying with exponents, it's exponential. And so that number gets massively larger, massively quicker, and its improbability increases exponentially. Okay? That's for one cell. Many, many. Well, it depends on which way. There's billions of cells within the human body, and of course, all kinds of different ones for different purposes and so on and so forth. But the point is that to create one minimally complex cell, it's astronomical. The number is astronomically huge. It just doesn't happen that way. So chance becomes the naturalistic miracle. That's really what it comes down to. And I talked about this at the beginning of the class today talked about how cultures, they always ascribe creation, the initial creation, to some sort of a deity or a greater power, and how chance has become the atheist slash evolutionist's God. It really has. Because in order for any of this to happen by accident, it is truly a miracle. And so we'll take God out of it and call it a naturalistic miracle, and that doesn't have, that doesn't make any sense then. It's an oxymoron. But chance becomes the God of evolution. So, is organic evolution a fact? Well, the theory of organic is invalid and therefore cannot be a fact because it's based on non-provable assumptions that fly in the face of science, that fly in the face of observation. There are two serious problems here with organic evolution. Something based upon an assumption is always just an assumption. Remember, evolution is based on 7 non-provable assumptions. And, of course, spontaneous generation is not scientifically plausible. Thankfully, at least to my knowledge, and I might be wrong, I wouldn't be surprised, but to my knowledge, nobody's spending money anymore trying to figure out if spontaneous generation is possible, other than evolutionists. But there's no direct study on this subject because it's not plausible. I mean, there's a difference between plausible and possible, of course, but it's not scientifically plausible. Oops, sorry. Clicked a little too quickly off of that one. And then, of course, the other fact about this, the other thing that we have to consider, is that one-time events cannot be studied by using the scientific method and are therefore outside the realm of scientific study, and therefore not a plausible explanation for observable phenomena. In other words, remember when they said that spontaneous generation had to have occurred, and it had to have occurred only once? It's a convenient way of saying that we cannot apply the scientific method to the theory of evolution. What is that guy's name, Sue, that I always forget? Michio Kaku. He's a guy, he's got, he advertises all over the place on the internet. He's got the tagline always goes, are you tired of reality television? And then there's all this stuff about learning about the universe and so on and so forth. His name is Michio Kaku. He's a very smart man. But I remember I talked to him on the phone when I first did this, probably, I don't know, 10 years ago, something like that. He had a talk show in the morning at one of the radio stations I used to work for. And he had an open line, and you could ask questions and whatnot. And I remember I called him to ask him about... I asked him a loaded question, and he knew. So he took my question, hung up on me, and then answered. So he didn't allow me to rebut, which is fine. But during the course when I was on the phone, he was talking about the scientific method, and somebody else had brought it up. Well, how do you this, that, and the other thing, and work within the scientific method? And he said, as evolutionists, we don't. We have to dismiss the scientific method in order to study evolution. That should be your first clue that something's wrong. So one of the things that the other, by the way, the question I asked him was about mutations and how do mutations become useful? How are they used in evolution? How are mutations, when they're 99.9% of the time, and that's not just a number I'm pulling out of the air, but it's truthful, are if they're most of the time, the vast majority of the time, deadly, how are they used in evolution? And he had some wonderful space for it, but anyway.
Wouldn't it be true if we said that for something to be plausible or logical, it would have to be something that's observable?
Yes. Yes. Yep. And again, it's not plausible, it's not logical, so then it's circular reasoning. It basically absolves them. They use something that's non-provable as an assumption, leave it aside, and then operate with the perspective that they don't have to examine that. So, one-time events, as I mentioned, are neither dependable nor universal, and by definition, they cannot be reproduced. So, is organic evolution a fact? The answer is no, because it's based upon non-provable assumptions that have never, ever been observed. And although they will say that, and actually when we get to talking about the bacterial flagellum, I read an interesting article, and I should actually bring it, but it was interesting because it was talking about how the bacterial flagellum is used as an example of what molecular biologists and creationists have taken on, an example of what's called irreducible complexity, meaning that all the components have to be there within the system in order for that device or that component to function. Without all the pieces being in the right place and at the right time and the right organization in the right quantities, the device wouldn't work. Well, with bacterial flagellum, that is very much the case. With bacterial flagellum specifically, there are several proteins that are not used anywhere else in any other version of the protein, of the bacteria. Nowhere else in the bacteria are several of these proteins used except in the bacterial flagellum. So the assumption that they came from somewhere else in the bacteria to be used in the bacterial flagellum is an example of what we would call irreducible complexity. Now, the other side of that is that there are many other structures within bacteria, within cells themselves, but bacteria specifically, that are very specifically tuned for a specific purpose and usage, and that use some of the same components as some of the components that are used within a bacterial flagellum. And so the example is that, well, because this particular piece is used in the bacterial flagellum, and it's also used in a vacuole in a bacteria, then there you go. There's your evolutionary component. No. When you build a house, if we were to talk to everybody in here, when they build a house, most of our houses are going to have walls and a roof, right? We're probably going to build it out of wood or steel, or not stone around here, but you're going to use common methods, right? Repetition and pattern is not evolution. It's signs of an intelligent creator that didn't feel the need to reintroduce the wheel every time. So at any rate, I'll try to find that article again, and I'll share it a bit more as we get through to that point. But at any rate, the conclusion from tonight is that organic evolution is not a fact. And it doesn't matter how many times people try to say that it is or that it is proven as a scientific law, it is not. Organic evolution is still and always will be a theory based upon standard scientific methods. Okay? Any questions or closing comments? No? All right. Thanks for your time.